supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we're talking about family law today, and most of us meet family lawyers when we need help with our intimate relationships, either defining them or protecting them somehow, as in a prenup, or ending them. Perhaps now more than ever, all sorts of families face legal issues around divorce, custody, reproductive technology, marriage, and unions. On today's show, we open the window a bit into the world of family law. Maybe I should say the wild and wonderful or wacky world of family law. We're going to get a sense of how some of the human drama and social issues play out in mediation and in the courtroom. My guests today are Margaret Claw and Michelle Southworth. Margaret Claw is a family lawyer here in Philadelphia. Her new book is Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche, and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. She joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Margie, and I understand that's the name you'd like to be called.
It is. Thanks, Dan. Margie. It's great to be here.
Michelle Southworth is a licensed marriage and family therapist with the Council for Relationships. She's also a licensed attorney here in Pennsylvania. She's in the studio. Michelle, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Dan.
So, you know, you're a licensed marriage and family therapist. I was tempted to call you a recovering attorney. I don't know where you fit in there.
That is how I introduce myself in circles that understand that term.
And you're not alone. We're also taking calls, and we'd like to hear from you. We're talking about the human side of family law, the changing landscape, what it means, what it does well, and what it doesn't do so well. We'd like to hear your experience. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And, of course, our guests are not here to offer legal advice. They can't do this. But they can help us understand the process of marriage contracts, divorce, and custody matters in general. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Margie, let's start with you. Your book, which was extremely well written.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Your book opens up with Darlene. She's a young woman with a 10-month-old baby. She had recently been choked and abused by her husband. She sought and received a protection order to keep her husband away from her and the baby. In reaction, Keith sought full custody. Okay. Seems like a no-brainer, yes?
You would think so, yes.
But
what happened in that case is that and she was a teenager, actually, Dan, and she wasn't married. It was her boyfriend. So I represented her in trying to get custody of the baby from this abusive boyfriend. And the reason that I wrote about this case is that it particularly resonated for me because I was a young lawyer, not that much older than Darlene. And she had this 10-month-old baby girl, and I had a 10-month-old baby girl at home. And I really felt for her, and I just cared so much about this case. And I was also very nervous about it. I hadn't done much custody litigation before. And what happened is that we went to court for a custody hearing, and the judge actually took custody of the baby away from both parents and gave custody of the baby to the father's parents, to the paternal grandparents. And this was just a shocking result that I cannot now remember even why it happened, but that's what happened.
What legal standing does the judge have to do that? I don't know if that's the right word.
But. Well, it's a really good question. it's a good question, because now actually grandparents do have a specific standing to seek custody in certain situations. But at that time, that law hadn't even been passed yet. I can't answer that question. I don't think he did have the legal authority to do what he did, but he did it, and he was the judge. And my client was just beside herself, and she, I will never forget that she, I took her out in the hallway, and she fell down on the floor, and she was crying, and she was screaming, "That's my baby. How could they take her away from me? I have the stretch marks to prove it." And she was showing her stretch marks to the court officers, who were just, didn't know what to do. And I felt horrible. I felt completely responsible for this terrible outcome. And that was a Friday, and I went home for the weekend, and I looked at my 10-month-old baby girl, and I just cried and felt sick, really, all weekend. And you want me to finish the story?
Go on.
So the coda to the story is that I came back to work on Monday. I had prepped and steeled myself for this conversation I was going to have with her, where I was going to explain our options and how we're, what we were going to do to try to get the baby back. And I, she called me up, and she said, "Oh, everything's fine. I got back together with Keith. He gave me a ring. We're engaged. Everything's going to be great. We're all living together."
Don't make us try to guess what happened to you when you heard that.
Well, I was, first I was furious at her for her bad judgment, what seemed to me a terrible, this is a terrible result. This guy had tried to choke her. He'd been abusive to her in the past. And then he gave her a ring and she's back together with him. Then I quickly shifted gears and was furious at her for ruining my weekend, for making me care so much, for making me look at my daughter and cry and question my professional skills and feel like a failure as a lawyer. And the reason that I wrote about that case, Dan, is that that's when I realized that I needed to have some kind of a boundary between myself and my clients, that I can't, I couldn't keep doing this work if I was going to feel this way every time I lost a case. And that Darlene's life was her life, and her kids were her kids, and my life was mine, and my kids were mine, and I needed to have some protection there between her and me. And that, I really pinpointed that moment when I was writing the book as when that started to happen.
I want to talk to you, Michelle, about boundaries. So I listen to Margie, and I get that, and it makes sense. But I'm thinking about that 10-month-old baby. And I'm in that situation quite often when I watch parents, whether they're together or separated, just do these harmful things to a baby and make horrible decisions that I know damn well are going to put a baby at risk. And I really have trouble making a boundary there. It's just something about our primordial instincts of protecting babies. Are you in that position when you mediate?
Well, it's interesting. When I mediate, the dynamics are different. I mean, the kind of case that litigates custody is not the kind of case that mediates. So you're almost comparing apples and oranges. I mean, I will say when I read that chapter in Margie's book, I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry, but I did know that it was that kind of situation that made me decide I didn't want to practice law. I was not able to create that wall in the way that Margie did. And I admire you tremendously for having been able to figure out how to do that.
On the other hand, you have a wall that you've created, but, I mean, you're a deeply caring, sensitive, self-reflective attorney. And some people would say, you know, that's kind of an oxymoron.
I don't think it's an oxymoron, because I think a lot of my colleagues...
Personal, by the way.
Okay. I've heard every lawyer joke. But a lot of my colleagues in the family law bar are incredibly compassionate people and care very deeply about their clients. And I think that that's the key to being able to practice family law, is that you have to care, because if you didn't care, you wouldn't want to do it. It's not a way to get rich. It's complicated. It's messy. You have to care about it. But you can't care so much that you burn out. And I think that's the key, is that there's a balance. And what Michelle is saying, I've heard from a lot of people who said, yeah, you know, I did one divorce case once and I just, that was enough. And I think it's too emotionally draining for them. But there is, you don't want to go over to the other side either, because then it wouldn't be so compelling as an area of practice.
I want to talk about that judge and judges in general. In family law, this judge makes a decision, and you say he's the judge, and I know legally, yeah, he's the judge. But judges, A, have their own baggage. They've got their own history, their own children, their own marriages or relationships that may be good or bad. And the law presumes they're objective, but they're not. So it's a problem area. And the other thing is, I've heard two friends of mine that tell me, who were judges, and tell me that family law judgeships are at the bottom of the ladder. That's the entry job. And most want to get out of it as soon as they get some work under their belt, some footing as a judge.
Well, I think in Philadelphia, that used to be true, and I'm not sure that it still is. I mean, I think there are some new judges who are assigned to family court who don't want to be there, but there also, we have a lot of judges now who want to be in family court, and some of them who practiced family law before they became judges. So I actually think the family law bench has changed that way. And then in other counties where we practice around Philadelphia, the judges tend to rotate in and out of family division of the court. And so they actually, you know, hear all kinds of cases. But back to the point you were making about judges being, having their own personal experience that then they relate to child custody cases, you know, that's a double-edged sword, because you want judges to have life experience. You want them to be wise. You want them to be pulling on what they know about the world. But the problem that comes up is that the standard is the what's in the best interest of a child. And that is, even though we have many factors they're supposed to look at, that is, I think, at the, you know, at its essence, that is a subjective determination. And they have to look at their own, back to their childhoods, or how they raised their kids, or how their kids are raising their grandchildren. And those experiences that really do color how they look at different parenting practices, whether they look at something as you're a bad parent because you're still breastfeeding a child that's four, or because you're sleeping in the same bed with a child. I mean, these are things that can really affect judges, and it's difficult, because I understand that they need to look at their own experience. I think we all do.
Yeah, and if it's processed properly, it helps
yes.
us with compassion. And if it's not processed, it bleeds into our decision making.
I think they have to be open to understand. The best judges are look at their own experience, but understand that other people parent in different ways, and try to have a more universal approach.
We're talking about family law and the nuance of it and the human side of it. We're talking with Margie Claw, who's written a great book called Keeping It Civil, Michelle Southworth, who is an attorney and a family therapist. And our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jessica on the line. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You?
I'm good, thank you. I'm so glad that you are covering this topic today. I'm actually going through a custody case right now. I'm a single parent. I have four kids. And I actually, there's two dads, and we all co-parent together. We all live nearby. We have meals together. We get along really well. The kids are happy, and everyone is amazed at how balanced they are. The custody case is actually, my parents are trying to get partial custody of my two older children. In May, I decided to walk away from my family. There was just so much fighting and negativity. And almost 2 weeks after I made that decision, I started receiving letters from lawyers, and now we're in court for it. And I guess my question is, why are there grandparents' laws? Like, why do they have rights that would interfere with the parents' rights? And are there actual cases where those grandparents' rights have actually helped kids? And I'll take my question off the air.
Well, yeah, but I do want you to hang on, because I'm going to toss this question. I mean, you can take it off the air, but make sure you listen, because I'm going to toss this to Michelle, who's both an attorney and a family therapist, because that's my first reaction hearing this. And it might not be realistic, but my first reaction is to talk to a family therapist here. Go on, Michelle. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, obviously, if there is some way to repair whatever the breach is between the parent and the grandparents so that this isn't the subject of litigation, that would be the first choice from a professional point of view. And I mean, this goes to sort of the issue of a judge making decisions about a family anyhow. I mean, as you were saying, people bring their own stuff for good and ill. And one of the reasons that people would pick therapy or they would pick mediation is they might prefer not to have someone who's a stranger to the family making decisions about the family's life. And so if you can go to therapy and reach some kind of understanding and resolution, if you can go to mediation and work out something that you choose together rather than that an outsider imposes, I think most of us would prefer to see that where that's possible. I think it's understood it's not always possible.
And you and I both know, treating families, couples where there's discord, that peace and justice are not always the same thing, that often you can't have both. You have to choose whether you fight for justice or pursue peace.
Right, and justice is sometimes an absolute and sometimes it's relative. Right. What I think is fair and what you think is fair, you know, may, if you describe it to a stranger, sound perfectly reasonable, and yet they don't match up.
So let's get to Jessica's questions about the law. Why do grandparents, I'll turn to you, Margie, why do grandparents have rights, and do they have the right to interfere with parents' rights?
Well, I would
and
say,
be careful here, because you're talking to a grandfather, so just...
I think the reason that grandparents have been singled out by the legislature for a special status in the law is the recognition that that it is often in children's best interest to have a relationship with their grandparents, and that they stand in a unique situation that's different than other people who would be called in the legal system third parties, meaning not parents.
Right.
They're different than other third parties, maybe an aunt or a friend or somebody else who has a close relationship with a child. Grandparents have been given a special status, but that doesn't mean that they stand on equal footing to parents. They have a much more limited legal status in general, and there are the way the laws are written, there is a balance struck, or there in the statute, between the grandparents' desire to have a relationship with grandchildren and the rights of the grandchildren to have a relationship with the grandparents is really what the statute's about, but not interfering with the parent-child relationship. So I can't really comment on the specifics of Jessica's case, obviously, because I don't know enough about it, but I mean, I think these are very complex cases, and there is a lot of heartache, and I've certainly represented a number of grandparents. There is a tremendous amount of heartache when they are cut off from contact with grandchildren, and it's a difficult area.
It sure is. Let's take a break. I want to talk more about this custody issue. Who decides, how it gets decided, and what happens after the decision? That's a complicated and something so many divorced people have lived with and continue to live with. We're talking about the heart and the complexities of family law with attorney Margie Klaw, who practices here in Philadelphia. Her new book is called Keeping It Civil. We're also joined by Michelle Southworth, who is an attorney, sometimes recovering, and is a family therapist. She's here with the Council for Relationships, also in Philadelphia. Our number is 888-477-9499. We would like to hear your story. We'd like to hear your question or your experience. 888-477-9499. Like I said, we're going to take a short break, come back, and talk more about custody. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about family law, I guess from the inside out, with Margie Klaw and Michelle Southworth. Margie, throughout your book, there's a case that you talk about. It's a custody hearing. Now, the mother knows the father can be very aggressive and harmful. One day the boy shows up with a mark on his arm, and she knows, and the little boy knows, that the father does this. This information was not admissible in court, and ultimately, father got partial custody. What happened to the mother after that? Do you know? Did you have contact with her?
Well, so that case is actually a composite of several different cases where essentially that very thing happened, where what I was particularly interested in talking about and exploring is where a child's statement to a parent in private about what happened to them was not admissible in court because of the rule against hearsay, and the child was either too young or too intimidated to tell the judge directly what he or she had told his or her parent. And for that reason, the evidence wasn't admissible in the case. And so that was what I was really writing about in that particular, you know, I kind of smushed together like three or four cases.
Smushed is a Latin word.
It's a term of art in the legal system, yeah. So when you say what happened to that mother, it's not one specific mother, but I can tell you without hesitation that the clients I've represented that had that happen to them thought that the legal system was totally unfair and was not protecting their children.
It's more than just unfair. I mean, how do you live with it? And maybe, Michelle, maybe you can address it. How do you live with it when the legal system puts your kids in harm's way? And Margie's story, I'm sure, happens over and over and over again. All right, so we know that's unjust, but how do you live with it, Michelle? Do you counsel?
Yeah, no, I have worked with people who've been in that very situation, and it's terribly painful. It's terribly stressful. I mean, as a practical matter, you know, the judge has decided, and unless you're going to pursue an appeal, which in Pennsylvania is a complicated, expensive, and kind of unpredictable matter, and most people don't, you live with it. And so how do you live with it? You know, you watch your children like a hawk. You pay attention to any future events like that. If you trust that your lawyer did their best and might be able to address it better if it happens again, you stay in touch with the lawyer and you really keep an eye on the situation. Sometimes you'll get cases like that where people will call in suspected child abuse, and so there may be repeated child abuse investigations. That gets old. I mean, I think your story tells how difficult it is to get a child abuse allegation
substantiated.
Yeah. And so you end up in a situation of great tension and anxiety that goes on and on and on and on. That's what you've got.
There's almost no cure
for
that.
Can I play devil's advocate for a moment here, though? Because I think it's important to point out that there is a reason that we have a rule against hearsay, and there is a reason why we might not want courts to make decisions based on what somebody says their child told them that no one else heard and that the child won't repeat. I mean, think of the potential for abuse of the system. Think if you could lose custody of your child because the person you used to be married to who hates you convincingly makes up a story to a judge about what that child told them. I mean, this is not that clear cut. And I was, you know, hopefully in the way that I told that story, and I think it was clear that my sympathies obviously lay with my client, but I also think that we have to always think about things from both parents' perspective. And there is a tremendous potential for abuse in allowing those statements in and relying on them. So it's really a complicated matter.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a caller right on this issue. We've got Frank on the line. Frank?
Yes.
Hey, Frank. So what's your comment or question?
Well, I was just listening to what was spoken about with a child that was having an issue and against alleged hearsay. And from what I understand, from time to time when youth services gets involved, it doesn't always necessarily indicate that there's enough of quote-unquote abuse to make a decision. At what point does the court system start to listen to a child about what they would like to see happen? In other words, what age is a child willing to be able to stand up and speak for themselves?
Yeah, let me add to that question. I guess I'll turn to you, Margie. At what point is the legal precedent for what point a child's report can be trustworthy, or is that in the formula? Go on.
So in this state, a child's preference and what they have to say in a custody case is admissible and actually is supposed to be sought by the judge. They have to be competent to give testimony, and that the definition of that for a child is that they understand the difference between the truth and a lie. They understand the nature of the oath to tell the truth. And so a judge will take a child into chambers and talk to them in open court, and they will first ask them about that. Do they understand what it means to tell the truth? And they'll tease that out a little bit. And if it seems like the child really does understand the difference between telling the truth and telling a lie, then they'll go on to ask them questions. And there's no bright line at which what a child says they want becomes controlling in a custody case, but the older the child and the more articulated what they have to say is, the more weight the court will give it.
The child is put in a terrible position of having to testify against one parent. And that's
It's a terrible position for a child to be in, even though, I mean, judges for the most part are very open-ended in their questioning of children, and they try to just get a sense from them of what the child wants to tell the judge. And I mean, this is the reason that Michelle is saying that mediation and family therapy are such preferable options for custody disputes, because you, the trauma that kids experience by having to be involved in that system is can be really substantial.
I would imagine, though, Michelle, if there's for people to go into mediation, they've got to start off being somewhat civil.
They have to have the ability to be civil. I mean, they're not necessarily civil at every moment. My office is known for the loud noises that emanate from it, but they have to have the ability to get there, and it has to be important to them. So, yes.
Yeah, so there's a different level. Do you mediate cases where there's abuse allegations?
Not usually, no.
Yeah, they've got to go to the courts. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, speaking of the courts, Margie, you know, life has changed dramatically in the last couple of decades. Family life has changed. Marriage, relationships, as you suggest throughout your book. Has the law kept up with all these changes?
I think the law has kept up in some areas, and in some areas the law is pushing society. Like the decision in Massachusetts, when the Massachusetts Supreme Court found that there was a state constitutional right for same-sex marriage. I mean, that was in 2004, I believe, and that was way ahead of the curve for the country. And that was considered by same-sex marriage opponents to be this outrageous decision. So that's an area where the courts are, you know, progressive and moving ahead. And then there are other areas where the culture is pushing the courts, I think. And that certainly in this state, on that same issue of same-sex marriage, that's what we have. I mean, we have a prohibition on same-sex marriage, but we have a public, a tide of public opinion that has shifted. And we have a number of lawsuits now filed and new legislation being introduced to try to change that.
So tell us about divorce in same-sex couples. How does that work?
Well, it would work the same way as with heterosexual couples, except if you have the misfortune to live in a state that doesn't recognize your marriage. So the sort of ironic situation we are in Pennsylvania is that a same-sex couple who got legitimately married, let's say in New York, let's say they went up for the weekend and they had a big party, had a wedding, and then they came back to Philly where they live, if that couple's marriage falls apart and they want to get divorced, they can't get divorced in Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania doesn't recognize their marriage. And other states, like New York, for instance, have a residency requirement to file for divorce. They can't just take Amtrak up to New York and file a divorce complaint in the court there. They have to be residents of New York. And so they're actually stuck being married. It's a very, it's ironic given how, you know, passionately advocates, how passionately gay and lesbian people have fought for the right to be married. And now, you know, guess what? They're just like straight people. Some of those marriages end in divorce. Now they can't get divorced in a lot of states in this country. I mean, I think that's going to go away because it seems to me it's a house of cards and it's falling down. And we will have a universal ruling at some point from the Supreme Court on the unconstitutionality of banning same-sex marriage. I think it'll be just like the interracial marriage case. And I think that's our future. And it's a question of when, but not if.
You just heard the voice of Margie Claw. She's a family lawyer here in Philadelphia. Her new book is called Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. We're also joined by Michelle Southworth. She's a licensed marital and family therapist with the Council for Relationships. She's also an attorney, and she does mediation. When we come back, I want to hear about money, and I want to hear more about mediation, what it actually is, what it looks like. And we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open. Again, it's 888-477-9499. What's your experience with family law, either as a consumer or as a family lawyer. Love to hear from you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The foundation can help those over age 70 transfer monies from individual retirement accounts to a fund designated to support your favorite nonprofit. Your financial advisor can provide information on how a charitable IRA rollover can be part of your estate planning and generate savings on income tax today and estate tax in the future. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about family law and I guess the human side of it. We had a caller earlier in the show who kind of ran out of money while he was working on his divorce custody arrangements. What happened? This is not cheap, family law.
No, it's not cheap, and it's a big dilemma for family lawyers and for people going through family law issues that need legal representation. There's no right to counsel in divorce or custody proceedings or child support proceedings. And if you go to court in Philadelphia, you'll see that I think the current statistic is something like 85 to 90% of the people there are not represented by counsel. It's mostly a court where people are representing themselves. And that is less true in the suburban counties where I practice, but it is definitely the case in Philadelphia. And I think that's also part of that dynamic is that people with lawyers tend to do a better job of staying out of court. Because lawyers negotiate and lawyers try to settle cases. And the people who don't have those resources, the court is, I mean, I think of court as the last resort. But if you don't have somebody to speak for you, to help you negotiate something, you need to just go to court and that's your tribunal.
Well, let me ask you, Michelle, what happens in your field when patients run out of money?
Well, I mean, it's a fee-for-service situation generally, although in the therapy field there are more low-fee alternatives that people can be referred to. I think in the family law area, that's one of the areas that just isn't funded. But for family therapy, there are low-fee alternatives that people can access.
And I'll tell you, most therapists I know personally, they'll take a pro bono case or two.
Or reduce a fee for a longstanding
client.
Or
reduce a fee. Mm-hmm. But.
And I would say that there's sort of a joke among family lawyers that we have. I'd say we in general do a tremendous amount of pro bono work as a percentage of the bar.
Right.
We tend to take a lot of pro bono cases. But there's also what we refer to as the involuntary pro bono cases. You know, the mm-hmm. clients that run out of money and you just feel that you have to keep representing them for one reason or another. And that happens to everybody that practices in this area.
Right, right. And in our field too.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We've got Brad on the line. Hey, Brad.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a quick question. I went through a particularly nasty and prolonged divorce 20 years ago. And back then I was told by the people that represented me that it was quite normal that the outcome on the financial side was that the husband would get half of the assets and all of the debts, and the wife would get half of the assets but none of the debts, but that was the rule rather than the exception. I'm wondering if that's still true in today's family courts.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm curious about whether it was true 20 years ago, and things sure have changed in the last 20 years economically. My divorce was about 25 years ago, and, you know, it was a, quote, traditional family where my wife, ex-wife, she wasn't working, and I was. And so, go on.
Well, I can understand why Brad was told that, and I think it's not quite accurate that the husband would get all the debts and the wife would not. It's more that debts and assets get divided up under our divorce code, and debts tend to go to the person who has the ability to pay, or they're shared in some way that more of the debt goes to the person who has the ability to pay. So if you have if you had a marriage where one spouse was not working or was economically dependent on the other, that person is unlikely to leave with a lot of debt to pay because they don't have the ability to pay it. But that's usually factored into the way the assets are distributed too. So I don't think that's changed in 20 years in the sense of the laws changing, but I think that family structure has changed. That's not as common anymore, although it's still, there's certainly a lot of families like that, but it's not as common anymore where only one person is working.
Michelle, when we had a conversation, you and I, a few years ago, you said that money is usually the biggest issue in divorce, sometimes even more than children. Why do you think that is?
Well, people see it as a finite resource and, you know, are very anxious. Divorce is a very anxious time in terms of what your future survival is going to look like. And people look to what the assets are there as the thing that's going to help with that. So there's a tremendous amount of anxiety around that, you know, which is not to say there's not a lot of anxiety about how the children's time will be shared as well. But I think there's a greater acceptance, at least in the cases that I work in, that the children's time will be shared and that it's a matter for the parents to figure out how they're going to do that. Whereas the finances, there's more anxiety about, will it be shared in a way that lets me survive? And
it really is about survival. Mm-hmm. It's the truth is it's money, but it's not money in the representation of it. It can feel like life or death. I would imagine that's a tremendous sticking point in your cases, Margie.
It is. And I would also say that, and this, of course, is completely anecdotal. I have no evidence for this, but from where I sit, you know, having represented so many people who are getting divorced, I think financial issues are the major reason that marriages seem to fall apart, like way more than infidelity or, I mean, there are other big ones are like substance abuse, alcoholism, mental illness, those type of things. But I think they all take a backseat to financial issues. You know, so many people that come in are just really, really upset about some aspect of their financial life. Either the other person isn't contributing or the other person is putting them into debt, or that they just don't agree about how money should be handled.
Talk about keeping it civil. There are a minority, in my experience, of course I'm a therapist, of couples who can have or do have a civil conversation about money. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to me? How should we balance it? Separate accounts, all one account. What do I think about money and what do you think about money? Michelle, it rarely happens.
It's a very emotional area for people, and money actually means different things to different people. I mean, I think when it comes to divorce, it gets that survival meaning attached to it. But people who are still married, you know, it may have a variety of other meanings, control, security. It can be all kinds of things to people, and so it taps into some very deep feelings and fears.
Speaking of deep feelings, before we go back to the phones, I want to pick up on one theme with you, Margie. You talk an awful lot about women and finances and how many women give up their careers or cut back to raise children. So what happens to them when the marriage ends?
Well, this is a subject that I'm on a soapbox about, is women opting out of the workforce for long periods of time to raise children. And I think it's a really dangerous thing to do. My partner, Joni Berner, has a sign in her office that says, "A man is not a financial plan." And I wholeheartedly endorse that. It's one thing to leave the workforce for two, three, four, maybe 5 years. But what I see happen and what really upsets me is women who are trained to be able to work and make and support families, women who've been to college, maybe to graduate school, who then work for a very short period of time, let's say, and then they have their first child, and they're married to someone who is making enough money that they can stay home. I mean, this is a subset of people. Many families don't have that choice. But I'm talking about where it's a choice to stay home, and then there's a second child, and then maybe there's a third child, and they wake up 20 years later, they've never worked except for, you know, maybe they practiced law for 2 years, maybe they have a law degree, maybe they were a nurse, and then their certifications have all lapsed, and they're 45 or 50, and their husband wants to get a divorce, and they have no way to support their family. And so they have no way to think about the divorce without it being just about survival. And that's what I see that's so different for women who have the ability to, you know, pay the rent, is they can have a rational conversation with themselves. Do I want to get divorced? Is this what's going to be best for the children? But the women who are financially dependent, all they can see is the electricity is going to get turned out and I'm going to be working at Starbucks, and they cannot, not that there's anything wrong with working at Starbucks, but I mean, you know, I can be working for $10 an hour. And I think that it's a risky life strategy because divorce is common. And so, your husband could die, your husband could become disabled. You're really you're putting all your eggs in one basket to opt out of the workforce for a long period of time. So that's my lecture. And I have two daughters in their 20s, and they're sick of hearing me talk about this. So I'll tell it to you instead, Dan.
No comment. let's go back to the phones. We've got Mike on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Quick question. I'm 25 now, and my parents got divorced when I was about 10, 11, maybe 12, which means I've now lived more of my life with divorced parents than married parents. And I remember at the time it was very, very difficult on my sister and I, and she's 2 years older than I am. It was very, very difficult to have to go through that at that young age. And I'm still, at this point in my life, I still have friends whose parents are just now getting divorced. And my friends are in their 20s, which means their parents are in their 50s, oftentimes 60s. And I can't imagine how hard that is for them, but almost for completely different reasons. I mean, I can imagine the psychology of that is just totally different, but not any easier. And I just kind of wonder what the differences are when you talk about reasons and then also emotional reactions are, what the differences are between families who see parents get divorced in their 30s or 40s, as opposed to their 50s or 60s.
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with any of that research, Michelle. I do recall we did a show years ago about the impact of divorce on older children in their 30s. Mm-hmm. And it's damaging. It's really harmful. So I don't know if you're familiar with that research.
Well, yeah. I mean, I try to educate my clients on sort of the developmental impact. If you're divorcing when you've got an infant, it's a different story than if you're divorcing when you've got preteens. And a lot of people think that they'll wait until the kids go to college and that'll be a good time to get divorced. And, you know, every age presents different challenges. So for the infant, you know, just having a custody schedule where they're away from one parent for any significant amount of time is a huge issue. If you've got pre-adolescents, you know, they've got all kinds of emotional turmoil that they're going through already and so on.
Yeah, I don't think any competent family therapist gilds the lily here about divorce not being horribly painful to children, no matter what age. And old research I read many years ago said that children are better off in families, even families that are problematic, as long as there is no violence, no abuse, and no constant hollering, verbal abuse to each other. And children are better off in those marriages. I don't know about the current research, but it's a painful truth that parents need to know.
I mean, I think the most current research says the level of conflict between the parents is the most important thing.
Yeah.
So if you have a terribly conflictual marriage, that's
exactly.
not great.
Exactly.
If you have a low-conflict divorce, that's probably better than the high-conflict marriage.
Let's see if we can conclude with a lovely call from Daniel, one of Margie's clients. Margie looks scared. Daniel.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'm going to have to keep it very, very brief.
Very
here.
Quick. I just wanted to put a little plug in for the good side of divorce. About 10 years ago, Margie represented me in my divorce. I shortly met a woman thereafter who also was represented by Margie. Today, we're married very happily, and we have 6 kids together.
That's great. Unfortunately, we got to go. Thanks so much for your call.
Problem.
Nice note to end with. I'm curious about how much Margie paid this guy, but that's all. That's for another show. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much.
My guests have been Margie Claw and Michelle Southworth, attorneys. We've been talking about family law. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about new innovation in behavioral health. Fascinating issues we're bringing up. Well, we'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices, or you can follow us on Twitter. We're Voices in the Fam. And reach me at drdangottlieb.com. I'd love to hear from you also. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is executive producer of audio content and helped us out with today's show. Thank you, Elizabeth. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer and today's phone answering person. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Do me a favor, please. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You're listening.